Welcome to Season 6 of the StoryGrid Editor Roundtable podcast. This is a show dedicated to helping you become a better writer by diving deeply into the StoryGrid method developed by Sean Coyne. My name is Leslie Watts, and I'll be leading the discussion today. Here with me are my fellow roundtablers, Valerie Francis, Anne Holly, and Kim Kessler. Each week during Season 6, one of us will pitch a story we want to analyze in order to get to the bottom of the specific story principle we're studying. The rest of us will analyze it according to our chosen topics, and together we'll deepen our knowledge and level up our craft. This week, I'm looking at It's a Wonderful Life in order to study point of view and narrative device. This 1946 film was directed by Frank Capra and written by Francis Goodrich, Albert Hackett, and Frank Capra, based on the short story, The Greatest Gift, originally published as a Christmas card in 1943 by Philip Van Doren Stern. As always, this is an adult conversation, and you may hear some adult words, and today's film touches lightly on the subject of suicide. So, let's turn to the story. It's a Wonderful Life is a worldview education story with a love story subplot. Like many worldview education stories, we have elements of George's working life to go with the love story, but this doesn't amount to a full performance subplot. For more on worldview education stories, check out the discussion in our Passengers episode. Now here's a quick breakdown of the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff of It's a Wonderful Life. Beginning hook. George is about to throw his life away, and the angel Clarence must learn about his life to help save him. George Bailey saves Harry's life and Mr. Gower from damnation, but when George's father dies and Potter will close the building and loan unless George agrees to take over, he must decide whether to forego college to save the institution or leave. He decides to stay and sends Harry to college in his place. Middle build. After college, Harry returns with a wife and a job, so George remains in Bedford Falls at the building and loan. Soon he and Mary tie the knot, but when Billy loses $8,000 for a bank deposit and Potter refuses to help George, he must decide whether he can best help his family by living or dying. He's about to take his own life, but is interrupted by Clarence. In the ending payoff, George saves Clarence, who grants George's wish to have never been born. But when George sees that everyone he cares about is worse off without him, especially Mary, who never marries, he must decide whether to ask for his life back or go on living without responsibilities. He asks, and his life is restored. He runs home to find that everyone has contributed to help him out of the jam, and of course, Clarence gets his wings. Now, this is an example when the film version of the story is much better than the prose version. Anne's going to talk a lot more about this in a few minutes, but in a nutshell, the short story consists of a stripped-down version of the end of the middle build and ending payoff. George wishes he'd never lived. A stranger grants the wish and shows George what life in his hometown would have been like without him. George calls for a do-over because he wants his life back.
Leslie, I just want to jump in here for a quick second. I agree with your analysis of the genre, but I think that there's also an argument to be made here for a worldview revelation. For example, the information George is missing that he ultimately gets at the end of the story is that the people he's been helping all these years are willing to help him too. Now, that's obvious to Mary, which is why she's able to get Ernie and Bert to help with the honeymoon and ultimately get the whole town to help raise the $8,000. And then some, they get even more than $8,000.
I kept seeing status for George as I was watching it. He definitely has inborn admiration qualities, and he always is following his own moral compass. I was thinking it would be status sentimental because he's so highly dependent on others in order to be successful in the end, as Valerie is mentioning. But I think it's one of those cases where if I was completing Friedman's framework, more than one of those internal elements would change. And so then we kind of have to step back and say, well, what is the story really about? And I agree that Leslie's conclusion of worldview education is really the big meta why that George has in the story and that we as the audience take away from the story.
I agree. I kept trying to shoehorn it into status admiration at the beginning, because George does have some of those steadfast moral compass kind of qualities that we find in a status admiration story. But that went right out the window as soon as we see the scene where George loses it and is mean to his own wife and children, which a status admiration character would never do. I sort of, you know, shoot from the hip here, but I figure the worldview education story is the one that ends when the protagonist can sing the refrain from that Chicago song, "I've Been Searching So Long."
Those are all great points. And the takeaway, I think, for our listeners is if you saw a different global genre, you're not alone. And thinking about the elements that led you to your conclusion will help you understand genre better. Okay, let's turn to the principle today. This season, I'm looking at point of view and narrative device, the subject of the third of the editor's six core questions. If genre is what your story is about, then point of view and narrative device are how you deliver that story to your reader. Now, while point of view tells you whether your story is, say, first person or third person, for example, and whether it's written in the past or present tense, the narrative device or situation tells you who's telling the story, to whom, when and where, in what form, and why. So while you are the writer and you write the story for your reader, there should be a fictional narrator or narrating entity that is delivering your story to a fictional audience. This is the case whether you reveal the fact to the reader or not. I go into the reasons for doing this, that is, for coming up with the fictional narrator and fictional audience, in my bite-size episode from a few weeks ago. But the main reason is that a specific narrative situation makes your life easier because you know who is delivering the story, to whom, under what circumstances, and why. Now, I'll include links to that episode and my point of view articles in the show notes, and be on the lookout for my forthcoming Story Grid beat, Point of View, The Primacy of Narrative Device. Now, I recently made the connection between narrative device and the controlling idea of the story. Being thoughtful about this connection helps you write and revise your story so that the way you present your story to the reader is consistent with and supports what the story is about. The controlling idea of the story is usually the lesson the narrator wants to convey, or the lesson that the narrator learns as a result of reviewing the events of the story. So I start my analysis with, what's the narrative experience? In other words, what do we actually observe in the film when it comes to how the story is told? In the opening scene, we hear prayers for George Bailey from his friends and family. Then we see a conversation between glowing stars that represent celestial beings discussing how best to help George. Clarence, an angel who hasn't earned his wings, is tasked with the job of helping George, and we learn that the boss has an hour to acquaint Clarence with the relevant details for the job. We see this through a series of flashbacks of key events from the distant and recent past. We hear the occasional voiceover that helps us understand what those events mean. And once Clarence has been briefed, we watch as he interferes with George's plan on the bridge, and we follow the two of them after Clarence grants George's wish to never have been born. Clarence then disappears once he helps George regain meaning, and we follow George as he is embraced and supported by the community. So what's the narrative device or situation? Based on that narrative experience, what can we tell about the choice of narrative device or situation? In other words, how do Frank Capra and the other writers deliver the story? I see two narrative situations combined in this story. The first is Joseph telling George's story to Clarence to brief him for the mission. Joseph wants Clarence to be successful in saving George, which then saves a lot of other people. It takes the form of an angelic movie reel that shows key events from George's life. This narrative is told from outside of George's story. Joseph isn't directly involved, and it's in the story's present. The narrative begins 1 hour before George considers taking his life and starts with events from the distant past. The second narrative situation is Clarence using those facts that he received from Joseph to help George see that his life is worth living, and also, of course, Clarence wants to become a full-fledged angel. The form is more experiential, like a virtual reality combined with a conversation. These two layers of narrative complexity help us hope that Clarence will be successful even when George is less than sympathetic, when he yells at Janie and at Zuzu's teacher, and when he drowns his sorrows at Martini's bar. Clarence's story provides a kind of bridging or scaffolding sympathy in that case. So what's the basic structure of the story? The film employs a fate structure, and I'll have a link to a source for that in the show notes. And this fate structure gives us a hint about the middle build crisis. What we know is that a lot of people care about George Bailey and that he's in trouble. Then the story is presented linearly with critical events from George's upbringing presented through flashback. Saving Harry, seeing how Potter treats George's dad, saving Mr. Gower, etc. And then we see the events that are the proximate cause of George's low moment at the bridge, Uncle Billy losing the money, and George's attempts to solve the problem. Now, once George encounters Clarence, the story continues in the present. What's the narrative drive? Well, we have dramatic irony primarily until George encounters Clarence on the bridge. So this means that sympathy is vital to the story, vital to our wanting to see it through to the end. And that becomes important when I talk about the short story. So what's the controlling idea or theme of the story? The theme, generally stated, is probably what Clarence writes in the copy of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer that he gives to George in the final scene. No one is a failure who has friends. But in story grid terms, the controlling idea is usually phrased as a statement of cause for the change that occurs for the protagonist. Written this way, with a worldview education story in mind, we might say, we find meaning when we remember that relationships are more important than financial success. So to me, the point of the film seems to be that it's not always easy to remember what truly matters and where we find the most meaning in life. Hard situations can distract us, so we need friends, family, and perhaps a little divine intervention to help us remember. The story and the narrative device work on multiple layers. It reminds the George Baileys of the world that life has meaning even when things get tough. Look to the important people in your life and find meaning in the beneficial sacrifices you make there. The story also reminds the family and friends of the George Baileys of the world that we all need to be reminded and helped up sometimes. So more and more, I'm finding that your narrative device and the point of view choices should be as unique and specific as your controlling idea, and the two are deeply connected. And looking at the short story on which this is based will help us see this very clearly. Again, the film is based on Philip Van Doren Stern's short story, and it's interesting to look at how the point of view and narrative device are similar and yet different. So what's the point of view and narrative device of the short story? The point of view of The Greatest Gift is selective omniscient. We have access to George's experience and thoughts, but not to that of other characters. The narrative device has a generic, godlike quality to it, and it's covert, meaning that the narrator isn't revealed to us. The story is linear, and though there are references to the past, we don't have any full-fledged flashback scenes. George does not come off as sympathetic in the short story. We don't know exactly why he's contemplating suicide, and he's really judgmental about what he thinks is the stranger's profession. We never attach to him, so narrative drive is limited to our wanting to see how things turn out. The filmmaker's decision to allow us to get to know George as a likable person whom others care about and who sacrifices his wants for the needs of others makes a huge difference in how we feel about him. And this has an impact on narrative drive. We care about George and we want to see that he gets out of this terrible situation. The controlling idea of the short story is either the same or really close to that of the film. George finds meaning in his existing circumstances thanks to the intervention of a stranger. But its execution doesn't deliver the emotional impact of the film. Now, I get choked up just thinking about some of the scenes in this film, but the short story really fell flat for me. Point of view and narrative device is a huge element of that successful execution of the film. So we have the same basic situation, the same core event, the same controlling idea, but the difference in narrative device makes the difference between a story that endures and sits near the top of the best films of all time and a short story that has largely been forgotten. Okay, so that's my take on It's a Wonderful Life. And you're going to talk about some other differences that matter between the film and the short story. What did you find?
Well, I found many interesting things, one of which I'm going to focus on here today. I just want to mention that the only writing course that I ever took that was focused on film, the professor introduced It's a Wonderful Life as the closest thing he knew of to a perfect screenplay. Now, this was ages ago, long before StoryGrid, and I don't remember exactly why he thought it was perfect, but it had something to do with setups and payoffs, which this film does handle extremely well. Now, I'm not comfortable proclaiming perfection in anything. There's a lot of opinion involved, and in a story that's already 75 years old, there are going to be some problematic elements that steal a few points out of the plus column. But it is a rare instance of film being way, way, way better than the story it's based on. Frank Capra and his team of screenwriters took the bare essence of the short story, The Greatest Gift by Philip Van Doren Stern, as Leslie has said, and poured life into it. So I thought it would be interesting to figure out how they did that. What can I, as a writer of stories, learn from the conversion of a nothing little short story into a beloved film classic that at least one professor thinks is perfect? There are so many answers to that question that I can only scratch the surface here, so I'm going to focus on objects of desire. Leslie touched on this one. One of the story's many failings, is that George Bailey has no apparent wants or needs. He shouts at the little man, who becomes Clarence, the guardian angel in the film, that he's sick of everything, stuck in this mud hole for life, bored with his work at the bank, and he implies that he wants an exciting life, and that's it. Without more specificity than that, he's just complaining. He's just whining when he says that he wishes he'd never been born. Wah, you feel like you just want to slap him. We have absolutely no idea why, other than that he's bored with his life. There's no force behind it. We gather that he's considering suicide, but we have no real idea why. It just seems petulant and selfish. He is not a sympathetic character. We also have no idea what this little man wants or even who he is. He's nameless. He's just a dispenser of miracles from some larger entity, which he calls the World Cleaning Company. So we can surmise that he's some kind of angel, but angels make terrible characters if they're just holy and saintly without any wants or needs. And this one is just a cipher. Now, as to Mary, who is the third character in the story, she barely appears in the short story. In the alternate world where George Bailey was never born in the short story, she's married to an abusive drunk, and we gather that she just wants to keep peace in her house. That seems to be her only want. She is a cipher, just like the little man. She's a housewife with no character traits. The story even uses the word indifferent to describe her attitude. Now, another problem here is there's also no noticeable force of antagonism in the short story. There's a Marty Jenkins mentioned as a bad guy because he embezzled a large sum from the bank where George works, and the bank closure took the whole town down with it. So that sort of a bad guy, but Marty Jenkins is just a name on the page. He never appears in the story. Now, Marty had a brother in the short story who is now the drunk married to our friend Mary, but he has no agency in the story either, except possibly as the last straw that makes George recant his wish about never having been born. So let's look at the screenplay. The first thing it did right was to establish objects of desire, very, very clear objects of desire, so clear. Clarence is first established as a bit of a loser in the angel business. He wants to get his wings, and to get them, he needs to succeed in helping George Bailey at the most critical moment of George's life. It's crystal clear, stated right in the opening scene in so many words. We are rooting for Clarence from that point on, even before we see him, except as a little animated dot crossing the heavens, because his desire to be promoted and recognized is so relatable. And his need to earn his wings by good deeds sets up a kind of little mini performance story, and we want to see him succeed like we always do with a performance hero. And then we launch into George Bailey's younger life, and we quickly learn what he wants, and needs. Like his short story counterpart, he craves excitement, but the screenwriters wisely get specific. George wants to travel the world and be an explorer. He's been nominated for membership in the National Geographic Society. He knows, this young kid knows about faraway places like Fiji. And he talks about this dream to everyone. The whole town knows what he wants. The first thing we see of him as a grown-up, as Jimmy Stewart, is he's buying a big suitcase with plenty of room for labels from Italy and Baghdad and Samarkand, where he plans to travel during the summer before he starts college. Now, it's true that the movie layers this on pretty thick in the beginning hook. When George is done with his travels and his college degree, which presumably is going to be in architecture, he says he wants to design new buildings and plan modern cities. He's telling his father this before he goes off to college. He wants to expand his horizons. His visions are too big for Bedford Falls and way too big for a job in his father's nickel and dime building and loan society. Now, his father foreshadows what George really needs to acknowledge that his work at the building and loan is important. Let's listen to that.
You know, George, I feel that in a small way, we are doing something important. It's satisfying a fundamental urge. It's deep in the race for a man to want his own roof and walls and fireplace. And we're helping him get those things in our shabby little office.
Turning to Mary, she has defined wants and needs, too. They're a little simpler. When we meet her as a young girl, she declares that she's going to love George Bailey till the day she dies. A little later, as a young woman, she discloses her desire to live in the old rundown house. She wants romance, but also security. She's not ambitious. She's steadfast. We see early on in the scene after the wild graduation dance party, where she and George are walking home in the borrowed clothes from the gym locker room, that what she's going to need is that steadfastness in order to deal with George's impetuousness. Now, another fatal flaw in the short story is that it totally lacks a force of antagonism. The film, by contrast, transforms the slight mention of a Mr. Potter in the short story into Henry Potter, the sixth most villainous villain in 100 years of film, as voted by the American Film Institute in 2003. And he is just a wonderful villain. Valerie's going to talk more about subtle and genre-specific forces of antagonism in the film, but I can't ignore Mr. Potter here. His wants are also crystal clear. He wants to own the whole town. He is driven by greed and malice, and his actions constantly push George to change. He has no internal genre and therefore no subconscious needs. What drives him? Again, it's stated outright in that same dinner scene between George and his father. It's an excellent use of a meal scene, by the way. And let's have a listen to the clip of that.
Smarty, you look tired.
Oh, I had another tussle with Potter today. I thought when we put him on the board of directors, he'd ease up on us a little bit.
Well, what's eating that old money-grubbing buzzard animal?
Oh, he's a sick man. Frustrated, sick in his mind, sick in his soul, if he has one. He hates everybody that has anything that he can't have. It's us mostly, I guess.
Now, Henry Potter is not a subtle villain. He's out and out irredeemably bad, like the Wicked Witch of the West. But unlike the Wicked Witch, he never even really gets his comeuppance, except to witness in the end that George Bailey is really richer than he is because George has friends, family, and supporters, and love. And it's kind of a curses foiled again moment, but Potter is absolutely true to his character from beginning to end, and he is the instrument of just about every hardship in George's life. You could even argue that Mr. Potter's meanness is what causes George's father's stroke, which launches George's whole set of sacrifices. So why is it important for us as storytellers to establish the wants and needs of the principal characters? First and foremost, so that there's something driving them, motivating them. The desire is what carries the protagonist across the threshold from the ordinary world into whatever adventure the story is offering. The wants and needs are closely related to the global genre, and in a worldview story like this, the protagonist often has to give up the want altogether, sacrifice it, and learn to accept the need instead. This is the root of that bittersweet win-but-lose ending that all the internal genres depend on. I have a lot more about the relationship between genre and objects of desire in my bite-size episode, Objects of Desire, which I will link to in the show notes. The objects of desire also help establish what's at stake. The screenwriters of It's a Wonderful Life clearly understood that if you want to raise the stakes and create empathy for a flawed character, which George clearly is, give that character a strong desire and then put it out of the character's reach. Take it away from the character, force them to give it up, and see what happens. Before the middle build, George Bailey has already begun sacrificing what he wants because circumstances force him into doing what he needs to do. The death of his father forces him to give up his travels and his college education, which is a very large sacrifice. Each stroke of bad luck that follows does two things. First, it forces George to make another sacrifice that will pay off beautifully in the closing scenes. And second, it helps us understand why George reaches the global crisis of considering whether to take his own life, which is where the story began. We have been clearly shown step by step why George has come to be standing on that bridge, considering jumping. Now, there is just so much more to say about how Frank Capra and his team of writers converted this one little nothing story into one of the most enduring and beloved American movies of all time. And I don't have time to go into all of them here. But what I can say is this. If you're interested in leveling up your story craft, do a side-by-side comparison of The Greatest Gift by Philip Van Doren Stern. It is only about 4,000 words. And Capra's great film, which is free on Amazon Prime if you happen to belong, going down the list of the editor's six core questions and looking at them side by side. I guarantee the analysis will return huge treasures.
Thanks, Anne. It's really astonishing the difference it makes when we establish clear wants and needs. Thanks so much again. All right, now, Kim, you're going to talk about the beginning of the story and show us how this is a great example of a powerful way to start a story.
Okay, stories are about change. So in order to craft a story, we need to understand how to craft change. This means we need to show a change has taken place. And the way to do that is having a clear before and after. The idea of a change itself insists on a before, during, and after, aka a beginning, middle, and end. The quote-unquote during here is that moment of change, a turning point, a fear, a ball of chaos. This principle of change applies to any unit of story, the global, the act, the scene, the beat, the subplot, whatever. So what is a beginning and what do beginnings do? Sean talks to us about the beginning from a global story perspective, and he specifically calls it the beginning hook. So that means that it's meant to hook the reader and it introduces all of the genre elements. The very first book I ever read on story structure, which I have to say thank you to Nancy Kress for writing this book, called Beginnings, Middles, and Ends, which I went searching for because I was trapped in the middle build of my story. And so I went looking for books that specifically told you how the hell to write the middle of a book. In it, she talks about specific things that beginnings do, middles do, and ends do. And one thing that she talks about is that in the beginning, you make an implicit promise to your reader, right? And I think this is a lot about what Sean's talking about when it comes to genre, right? We're introducing all of these elements. And then she has four specific elements that she includes: character, conflict, specificity, and credibility. Throughout this season, I'm going to be digging in a little bit more deeply, kind of going back to my roots and digging into this book a little bit more. She does some really great things about looking at how you use your beginning, middle, and end at the line level, which is what I'm really interested in. So anyway, more to come on this one, but I just wanted to introduce this book to you here if you're interested in checking it out. Another source that I go to for how to craft great beginnings is Blake Snyder and The Save the Cat. He has a couple really awesome beats that he uses in beginnings. One of them is called The Six Things That Need Fixing. So it's where you're introducing the character to their world and you see that not everything is okay, right? And that's why we need to have the story, because things need to change. And he also has another beat called Theme Stated, which is where the genre and the big meta why and what the story is really about gets dropped in for the viewer or reader. Okay, so that's just a little bit of background, some of the sources, obviously, that we're going to be looking at over this course of this season as I examine beginnings. We have the specific function of the beginnings within the global story, and then from there, we have components of a beginning and their specific functions within it. In order to create the change that occurs in a beginning, we need that initial life value to first be established and then shifted. Here's a couple common pitfalls that I have noticed about beginnings. The first being not showing the before and just jumping to the during and the after. Change is most meaningful in context of how things used to be, so we cannot negate the status quo. And I don't think that status quo means boring, right? I mean, it might be boring to the protagonist because it's normal, but it's not boring to the reader because they are learning about it all for the first time. So pro tip, introduce the status quo with specificity to create interest. Another problem would be no complications. They make the status quo boring and idyllic where nothing happens. And again, a status quo doesn't mean nothing changes. It just means that the things that happen are not out of the ordinary. For example, if the pipe in the bathroom bursts again and the water's flooding all over and it's the fourth time this week, it's chaos, but it's still business as usual. The status quo is the typical kinds of frustrations the protagonist is used to and or something that can be resolved quickly. So again, there might be a problem, but it's either a problem that they know or it's a problem that they can resolve quickly. It's not necessarily the incident that prompts the major problem or question of the story that Nancy Kress refers to as the promise of the story. Another problem would be introducing too much too soon. Even when you do establish the status quo, beware of moving the story too far too fast. I'll never forget that episode of the original main StoryGrid podcast where Tim's working on the threshing, and in the opening scene, he has Jesse use violence early on. She stabs the guy in the leg, or she has a gun, or something happened. And Sean was like, no, that doesn't work. And he says, it's too much. It's out of the realm of reality or just like what the reader's expecting. And anyway, he had all kinds of amazing things that he was saying about it. And it's really stuck with me about making sure we're taking our time and pacing. This doesn't mean that every story needs to be a slow burn, but it's important to set up the before properly so that the reader is oriented with the expectations that can then be paid off. All of this relates back to things that Leslie and I have been talking about with conventions and obligatory scenes.
I just want to thank you for that first point, Kim, about not showing the before. I see it all the time. It's a tendency that I think is particularly strong among new writers to shortchange that beginning and plunge directly into the action for fear of being boring. This happens at the global story level a lot, but I see it at the scene level all the time. The writer seems to hesitate to take time to set the scene and instead opts for that in media res, that in the middle of the action opening. And then that puts him in the position of almost invariably having to backtrack and inserting a paragraph of explanation of how the character got there. The character had done this or had thought of that just prior. And so it stops the action and goes back anyway. So why not start with setting the scene? It's a problem that exists at the global and the micro level. And it is a thing all writers should really watch out for.
Absolutely. I see it with clients all the time. And yeah, it's like, why not just tell it in order? And it's so funny when I make that suggestion, like, well, why don't we just go back here and go ahead and start here, back up the scene a little bit and open it here. And then we can see this thing go in. And they're like, oh, as almost as if they didn't realize they have permission to do that. It's a fascinating thing.
Permission granted.
Permission granted. That's awesome. Okay, so let's look at the beginning of It's a Wonderful Life and see what it's made of, and how it functions, and really why it's so powerful. First of all, which beginning are we going to look at here? The beginning of a global story is the beginning hook. But I wanted to drill down a little more than that. What is the beginning of the beginning hook? Now, you can slice it and dice it how you want. But for my purposes today, I'm going to look at the scenes that come before the turning point of the beginning hook. This kind of fits within my before, during, and after definitions, where the quote unquote during is that turning point progressive complication of the act, the beginning hook. Anything that comes before the turning point progressive complication of the beginning hook is what I'm going to be examining. Now, I originally thought I would be looking at just up to the inciting incident of the beginning hook, but it turns out that going with the turning point progressive complication feels more useful, at least for today. We'll see where things go in future episodes. There are several tools that we can use to evaluate the beginning of the story. Leslie gave us the five commandments in her paragraph of the overview of the story. So we know how the act works in general because it has a turning point that shifts the life values and forces a crisis decision. This is kind of equivalent to completing the story grid spreadsheet on your scenes, but in this case, we're measuring the act instead of a scene. And you can evaluate any unit of story using the spreadsheet, though certain ones are likely to be more valuable than others. So it's just the same tool, but just a different level of resolution. In my case, I want to zoom in a little bit closer. My process for this was to first just make a rough scene list. And it's not the full spreadsheet. We're just talking about like the story events, what literally happens in the scene. And then I was noting what the audience literally learns in each moment, and then what that means in context of the story, and then what this means in a more abstract, generalized way. So it was a kind of a three-step process. So I made my little list, and then I went through and I said, okay, of this scene, when this happens, what does that tell us? And kind of tried to draw out what those things are. And then I kind of tried to abstract them and say, okay, so what is this doing for us in context of the beginning and in context of the turning point that's going to come? Let me kind of show you what I mean. In the beginning hook, I've identified that we have four sequences, and each within a specific time period. Sequence one is in the present. People are praying for George Bailey, and then there's the conversation by the angels that's setting up that narrative device. In sequence two, we jump to the past when George was 12. And then in sequence three, it's also in the past, but it's when George was preparing to go to college. And then sequence four is in the past, but it's 3 months after the previous sequence, which is 3 months after George's father's death. Each of these sequences is accomplishing a specific task. So let's look at sequence one. This sequence opens the story. It introduces the framing device that Leslie was talking about. This is a story being told and shown by one angel to another. It introduces the setting. We have our location, the time of year. There's the sign that says you are now in Bedford Falls. It's snowing. I think we learn that it's Christmas Eve, maybe from the angels when they're talking. And then it introduces characters. Everyone's praying for George Bailey. Who's George Bailey? We're introduced to like all these different people in town. We don't see them, but we see, you know, maybe the signs of their business. We hear their voices. We know that he has friends. He has a mother. She's praying for her son. And then we know that he has a wife and that he has children, and they are specifically praying for him. Also, we are introduced obviously to the angels, and we learn that one of them is a screw up who's going to be sent to save George Bailey. And so there's definitely some stakes there. Is he going to be able to do this? Also, it introduces the stakes, which in this case would be our life values. We know that everyone is praying for George. That means that something is wrong with George. So we're wondering what's going on. And then Joseph, the angel, he says it very specifically. Clarence says, is he sick? And he says, worse, he's discouraged, which I personally found very amusing because I think he's right, right? Being discouraged is kind of like the worst thing in the world. So he says, at exactly 10:45 p.m., he'll be considering throwing away God's greatest gift. And this is when we learn that it's his life that's on the line, and there's only 1 hour left. In this case, it introduces a means of turning the plot, the fact that George is planning to kill himself, but help is on the way. So all of that is told to us, and we're informed about all of that in various means in that opening sequence. In sequence two, this starts the journey of how George ended up where he is now, which is contemplating suicide. We jump back to when George was 12, and we introduce George, and we get a sense of his character. And by character, meaning, you know, his strength of will, his moral code, that kind of thing. George is the kind of person who jumps in the freezing water to save his brother, right? He's courageous and bold, and he's going to do the right thing. We are introduced to several different means of turning the plot. We have the nasty antagonist that's in town, Mr. Potter. We are introduced to Mary's feelings for George. We're introduced to the building and loan and Uncle Billy, who is very forgetful. And we are also introduced to George's dad, that he's a man of integrity and Potter is not. And as Anne was mentioning, we're introduced to George's wants. George is ambitious. He wants to travel and explore, and he shows Mary his maps, and I've been nominated as a member of the National Geographic Society, and all of these really adorable things. And then it goes on and it reinforces George's character two times. We realize that George is the kind of person who stands up for his father, and he speaks his mind in a room full of adults in front of the meanest man in town. We also learn that George is the kind of person that is honest and compassionate and always does the right thing according to his own moral code. And we see this in the way that he handles Mr. Gower's mistake, which I was absolutely sobbing during that scene. In sequence three, these are significant events that led to George's situation. They establishes the course that George's life was on and then how it got rerouted. So again, we're reinforced to George's character that he's still George, that's adventurous and his exploring self, and he's being the person that he always wanted to be. And we see that he is a town favorite. He gets along with people. He's well-liked, all of that. It reinforces George's want, again, to travel. And it shows us the sacrifice and effort that he's been willing to make to go after what he wants. He's put off college. He's saved. He's worked. And he's done what he needs to do in order to now go on and do this thing. He's going to go to college, but he's also going to take this trip to Europe first. Next, it clearly states George's belief about what constitutes a meaningful life and the life he wants to have. This happens during a conversation with his father at the table, and we hear the way he feels about this town, the building and loan, and the life that he wants.
I suppose you've decided what you want to do when you get out of college.
Oh, well, you know what I've always talked about. Build things, design new buildings, plan modern cities. All that stuff I've been talking
about. Still after that first million before you're 30, huh?
No, I'll sell half that in cash.
You wouldn't consider coming back to the building and loan, would you? I know it's soon to talk about it.
No, not Pop. I couldn't. I couldn't face being cooped up for the rest of my life in a shabby little office. I'm sorry, Pop. I didn't mean that. It's this business of nickels and dimes and spending all your life trying to figure out how to save 3 cents in a length of pipe. I go crazy. I want to do something big and something important.
Within all of this, we get more means of turning the plot. We see that Potter is still a force of antagonism and that he has a strong hold on the town. And we get this through George's father's words. We also see that George's father seems pretty worn out, which again is a setup for what comes later. We also see that George and Mary have a powerful connection, and the chemistry that they have, it's a progressive complication via a tool. Also, the high highs of this evening when they're out at the dance, it sets up a strong contrast for the blow that's about to come. And then, of course, we have the specific event that takes George's life off course. This is his father's stroke and then death, which is the turning point progressive complication of the beginning hook. Then we have sequence four, which is the aftermath of this major event, which leads to George's crisis, his decision, and action. By taking the time to clearly establish George's character and his wants, everything about the story events becomes more meaningful, aka we understand what it means. We get it. It's a big deal for George to finally be going on this trip and then to college. He's worked his ass off to make that happen, and we're happy for him because he's a great guy. He deserves to go out and live his life fully now. And so it makes the moment of the change, this revelatory turning point progressive complication when George learns about his father's stroke, all that more devastating. Then we find out that he's missed his trip. Oh, but he's still on his way to college. Yay. Until Potter starts talking crap about his dad again. And George says, nope, not on my watch. And George Bailey proceeds to give the most epic rant ever.
Just a minute. Now, hold on, Mr. Potter. Just a minute. Now, you're right when you say my father was no businessman. I know that. Why he ever started this cheap penny ante building alone, I'll never know. But neither you nor anybody else can say anything against his character, because his whole life was... Why, in the 25 years since he and Uncle Billy started this thing, he never once thought of himself. Isn't that right, Uncle Billy? He didn't save enough money to send Harry to school, let alone me. But he did help a few people get out of your slums, Mr. Potter. And what's wrong with that? Well, here, you're all businessmen here. Don't it make them better citizens? Doesn't it make them better customers? You said that they... What'd you say just a minute ago? They had to wait and save their money before they even thought of a decent home? Wait for what? until their children grow up and leave them, until they're so old and broken down that you know how long it takes a working man to save $5,000? Just remember this, Mr. Potter, that this rabble you're talking about, they do most of the working and paying and living and dying in this community. Well, is it too much to have them work and pay and live and die in a couple of decent rooms and a bath? Anyway, my father didn't think so. People were human beings to him, but to you, a warped, frustrated old man, they're cattle. Well, in my book, he died a much richer man than you'll ever be.
When George learns that the board will only vote to keep the building and loan open if he takes his father's place, this is also a revelatory turning point progressive complication. And I'm just not entirely sure what unit of story, if it's for the beginning hook or if it's just for this little sequence here. It certainly is within that scene itself. It's a little layered and I hate using this word, but squishy. I think that it's as if the two scenes, Dad's stroke plus this ultimatum by the board, are kind of this double whammy turning point progressive complication. It's progressively complicated the level of irreversibility. And because the story has set up George's character and his wants so clearly, we cannot help but be gut-wrenched and conflicted right along with him.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. Thanks, Kim. I really appreciate your highlighting the way that the film is establishing George's before, his current position, before things change. And this is a critical element that I think is missing from the short story. Now we're going to hear from Valerie on the forces of antagonism.
Thanks, Leslie. As Leslie just said, this season I'm working on the forces of antagonism. In other words, who or what is pushing against the protagonist and forcing him to act and forcing him to change? Sometimes the answer is pretty obvious because the force of antagonism is an external villain, but that's not always the case. If you do a quick Google search on great villains in literature or in film, you'll discover that, just like everything else in this industry, there is no one agreed upon definition or categorization of forces of antagonism. Surprise, surprise. Personally, I like Stephen Pressfield's approach because it was in reading the posts over on his Writing Wednesdays blog that I was finally able to get a handle on this archetype. Christopher Vogler calls it the shadow, and I'm sure there are other story theorists with different names for it. But for the purposes of my study here, I'm following Steve's approach. I started my study a couple of years ago with a Fundamental Fridays blog post called Stories Need Great Villains, which I'll link to in the show notes. My two main takeaways from that project were, first, that the hero, victim, and villain roles are intertwined. It's very difficult to talk about one without reference to the others. And two, this is a massive, and I mean massive, topic that deserves its own book, and I do plan on writing that book, and my research for it is starting right here, right now. I won't have time, obviously, here on the podcast to pass along everything that I learn, so if you want the other information, you can go to my website and sign up to the Inner Circle, valeriefrancis.ca/innercircle. So, forces of antagonism, according to Steve Pressfield, fall into three main categories: external, societal, and internal. External forces of antagonism, as Steve explains it, are external villains that present existential threats to our physical existence. These sons of bitches will kill you, eat you, freeze you, and boil you. Societal forces of antagonism are societal beliefs, such as racism, or in the case of Pride and Prejudice, the class system. When the force of antagonism is internal, the protagonist is his own worst enemy. His beliefs, behavior, and attitude is what's keeping him from getting his objects of desire. You've probably heard the saying, "I've seen the enemy and he is me." Well, that epitomizes the internal force of antagonism.
Hey, Valerie, I have a question.
Yeah.
I guess I don't understand existential threats to our physical existence. Can you talk a little bit more about that? It made me pause and I wanted to hear more about it.
Yeah, well, for today, what I'm trying to do is just give a real high-level approach, and Steve does go into it more in his Writing Wednesdays blog post. But for now, all you need to know is that an external force of antagonism is something outside the protagonist. It could be like Jaws, for instance, or in the superhero movies, you have a physical being that is the villain, or it could be like in The Martian, which we'll talk about later, it's the environment. So it's something outside the protagonist that threatens the protagonist's physical existence. Does that help?
Yes. Thank you.
In It's a Wonderful Life, what kinds of forces of antagonism are we dealing with? Well, as in most stories, there are a couple. We've got a main villain and we've got lesser villains. So we've got the villain and his minions. Everything goes back to genre. Since this is a global internal genre story, it will come as no surprise to hear that the main villain is also internal. George is his own worst enemy. It's his beliefs and his perspective on the world that are keeping him from seeing how wonderful his life is. He's doing what he believes is the honorable thing by staying to help the people of Bedford Falls, and he does recognize that he, through the building and loan, is helping to improve the lives of the people around him. However, he also sees what he's giving up, which is his dreams of travel, higher education, architecture, and financial wealth. He sees the struggle and the strife, and in the end, it overwhelms him. In the end, he is only able to see the problems. He can't see that with Bailey Park, he has actually fulfilled his dream of doing something big, something important. Now, Mr. Potter is an obvious external villain. Anne just went over this. And while he's pivotal to the story, since this is a global internal story, he's a bit lower down in the force of antagonism hierarchy than George's internal struggle. After all, Potter isn't the one who tells George to kill himself. He does provide the circumstances for George's desperation, and he does make that offhand comment about the insurance policy, but he's not suggesting that George commit suicide. He wants to put the building and loan out of business. He doesn't want to kill George. Now, if you want to write a global internal genre story, this is something you really need to understand. Although the main force of antagonism is within the protagonist, you still need something or someone in the external environment to poke that internal element. I'd argue that there's also a societal force of antagonism here too. For the most part, George's family and friends are encouraging him to go and explore the world and fulfill his dreams. However, his father's request that he work at the family business plants a seed in his mind. And once that seed is planted, it doesn't really matter that his father backs off. The comment is a setup to a payoff and an even bigger societal force of antagonism that happens toward the end of the beginning hook. The building and loan board of directors agree not to sell the company to Potter, but only if George stays on to run it. To understand how the writers pull this off, let's look at the three-act structure. Now, Leslie has already articulated the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff for It's a Wonderful Life, so I won't repeat it here, but I want you to keep it in mind. The beginning hook is essentially one big setup for the ending payoff, right? As Kim just explained, in it, we understand what kind of person George is and what kind of world he lives in. His belief that community needs trump personal needs influences every decision that he makes. It's no surprise then when he decides to stay at the building and loan rather than go to college. You may have heard Sean say that the beginning hook and the ending payoff rhyme. And that's definitely the case here in this film. Because of George's belief that the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, he sacrifices his own safety in both the first and third acts to save someone else. Both times he jumps into icy water, he saves his brother first, and then a stranger who, as we know, is Clarence. This same belief is what causes him to consider suicide. Potter, the external villain, feeds the belief and turns it against him. When he tells George that he's worth more dead than alive, George once again decides to sacrifice himself for the good of the community. But here, his belief, which was honorable, is now twisted and distorted. You may have also heard Sean say that the middle build belongs to the antagonist. So what does the middle build of It's a Wonderful Life look like? Essentially, there are a series of events or antagonistic forces that raise the stakes. They test and erode George's belief until it finally becomes the thing that will destroy him. Here's a couple of highlights. First, we've got Harry returning from college with a wife and a job offer from another company, and George puts Harry's needs ahead of his own. The pressure's starting to build now within George, and the stakes are beginning to get higher. He's already given up his chance to leave Bedford Falls once, and now he's doing it again, this time for good. When the bank calls the Bailey brothers' loan, George gives up his honeymoon, both the trip and the cash, to save the company. Then we see Sam's financial success, and it's a painful reminder that George is not wealthy, and actually that he turned down an opportunity to invest in the plastics company, which is the very thing that made Sam rich. Fresh from that humiliation, George receives an offer of 10 times his annual salary from Potter. I did the math. He's tempted to accept, especially since the deal will enable him to travel, but once again, he puts others' needs ahead of his own and decides to stay with the building and loan. Finally, and this is the straw that breaks the camel's back, when Uncle Billy loses the $8,000 deposit and George is facing bankruptcy, he goes to Potter for help. Potter actually refuses, telling George that he's worth more dead than alive. This perverts George's guiding belief and makes him think that the only way out of this situation is suicide. So George's object of desire is to achieve something big, something important. And he's defined that goal as leaving Bedford Falls, traveling, and building grand things elsewhere. Everything conspires against him, his internal attitudes and beliefs, Mr. Potter and society, to keep him from getting that goal. However, what he ultimately realizes is that he has done something big and something important. His perception of his situation changes, and he realizes that he's created a future for the people of Bedford Falls. He's forged relationships. He has a loving family, and all in all, it's a pretty wonderful life.
Oh, indeed it is. Okay. Thanks, Valerie. I really appreciate how you highlighted the relationships between the different antagonistic forces and how one is primary, but the others might be present as well. Okay, so now we're going to put together some final thoughts. Here are a few key takeaways to highlight the least you need to know to take your next step. For my part, the first takeaway is periodically I like to trot out the quote from John Gardner, and I'm paraphrasing here, that in contemporary writing, you can do whatever you want with point of view as long as it works. I think the key to making sure it works is to make a thoughtful choice about your narrative device and check that it's consistent with your story's controlling idea. If you don't want to reveal the narrative device to the reader, as it's done in It's a Wonderful Life, then don't. But don't use that as a reason not to spend time and effort on this very critical choice. My second takeaway is that an important part of making a thoughtful choice is studying the decisions that other writers make in their stories, especially when you can compare two similar stories. And the final takeaway is that ideas are important, but an idea must be well executed to transmit the core ideas and emotions to another person. And that takes time, effort, and study.
Hear, hear, and that leads into my takeaway that I will be hammering on all season. If you write novels or short stories, study novels and short stories, even when there's also a film. There is so much to learn from analyzing a text. Now, if you write screenplays, there's still a lot to learn about what makes a good screenplay by analyzing the film along with the novel or story that it was based on. Read more, basically, is going to be my unending message.
So for me, in order to craft a beginning that works, you need to know the end. That is, the way you want the reader to feel when the story is over. And then understanding that in order to create that change, there is a before, during, and after. This structure exists at every unit of story. Do not negate the before in your beginning and in the beginning of your beginning. Establish your life values before a turning point takes place.
And I'll just finish up by repeating something I said a minute ago. Global internal genre stories, which have internal forces of antagonism, still need an external force of antagonism to highlight that internal element and drive the change in the story.
Excellent. Okay, to wind up the episode, we take questions from our listeners. This week's question comes to us from Mark Lowe's on Twitter. Mark writes, I've literally burned through 94 episodes of the flagship podcast in less than a month. Quick question. I'm writing a story similar to The Martian in which someone must escape the Arctic. The environment is the villain. What's the MacGuffin there? Is there an episode on this? Valerie is going to answer this. So Valerie, take it away.
Thanks, Leslie. Okie dokie. First of all, I can understand how compelling Sean's method is for you. It compels me too, and I absolutely relate to burning through as much of it as possible, as quickly as possible. And I genuinely applaud your commitment to learning more about the craft. I really do. But here's the thing. This information's pretty complex. It's got layers upon layers. So consuming that much information that quickly means that you've missed a lot of valuable stuff. I'm in the process of listening to the flagship podcast episodes again. Yes, from the beginning. And I'm picking up things I either didn't get the first time or that I've forgotten. Likewise, I continue to go through the StoryGrid course material because even though I've heard that material multiple times, like I've done the Level Up Your Craft course about a half dozen times already, I'm still learning new things. Repetition is the key to learning. The StoryGrid methodology does not reward speed. It just doesn't. There are too many concepts here to learn. What it does reward is patient study and practice. That said, the MacGuffin is, yes, there's multiple sources of reference for the MacGuffin. It's discussed on several episodes of the flagship podcast. We've talked about it here on this show a number of times. And one of our colleagues, Larry Pass, wrote an entire Fundamental Fridays post about it. It's called What's a MacGuffin Anyway? And I'll link to that in the show notes. Essentially, a MacGuffin is what the antagonist wants. So in The Martian, the villain is Mars, and by extension, the environment on Mars. It wants Mark Watney's life. It's an action story. The whole thing is life and death. It wants to keep Watney from surviving long enough to get home. The environment on Mars does not support human or plant life in any way. So its very nature throws up endless obstacles. I recommend that you go through the novel and the film and observe how the environment gets in the way of Watney achieving his object of desire, which is to survive.
Great. So if you have a question about point of view, narrative device, or any other story principle, you can ask it on Twitter at StoryGridRT, or better still, by going to storygrid.com/resources, clicking on Editor Roundtable Podcast, and leaving us a voice message. That wraps it up for this week. Great discussion. Thank you, Anne, Kim, and Valerie, for your excellent editorial insights into It's a Wonderful Life. We hope our discussion has given you a better grasp of how to think about narrative device and point of view in your own stories. You can find links and additional materials in the show notes at storygrid.com. I always recommend you check them out. They are full of lots of treasures. If you want to connect with one of us directly, links to our websites can be found in the show notes. To support the show, we would love it if you'd leave us a rating and review and tell your writer friends about us. Join us next time when Kim will look at life values in beginnings within the context of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. Why not give it a look during the week and follow along with us? Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.